And we are live. Oh, we should probably unmute in the Discord. All right. Hello, everybody. It is Tuesday, June 7th, 2022. This is the weekly Wensoon show with Cal, all things Leo Finance, Cub, Polycub. And as per the usual, before we actually hit the live button, we were talking about all kinds of things that you guys might want to know about. So Cal, why don't you give us a recap of the last like 10 minutes of plans for Cub? Because, you know, Cub often feels like the forgotten stepchild because all the focus is on Polycub right now.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the cool thing that we're doing right now is basically we've spent so much time developing Polycub and all the contracts behind it. And now is kind of the crunch time to implement the different contracts. So the cool thing now is seeing all of this stuff roll out for Polycub, and then obviously, you know, migrating all that stuff over to Cub in kind of one massive one fell swoop. So when it comes to like things like X Polycub and PHBD and PHive, I think we're seeing a lot of success with that model. And kind of taking that success and then pushing it over to Cub is going to be kind of what Cub has been waiting for, which is basically a massive round of updates all at once. And there's a couple reasons why we're doing it that way, but essentially, you know, what we were talking about before is before we got on is Cub's basically reached a market cap of 600,000, which is crazy low. We were talking about the inflation rate and the model for Cub going forward. And, it's what we're thinking is, and obviously this can all be put to governance, but what we're thinking is, with Polycub, we've got this model of protocol and liquidity and soaking up capital, for that protocol and liquidity. So, as that protocol and liquidity grows, the treasury can leverage it to generate yield. And then it uses that yield to buy Polycub, and that's where the long-term LP incentives will come from. So essentially the platform will be buying Polycub on the market and then distributing it to that LP pool. And then from that LP pool, that's where all the liquidity pools get paid APY from. And then obviously the governance votes every week will determine which vaults get the most of that yield. So it kind of creates that built-in utility there in the long run. And what's cool with Cub is that right now we have a buy and burn model. So with Kingdoms, which is the only way that Cub accrues value, which up until recently was the only way that Polycub accrued value, but we realized that we needed a more sustainable model. Cub accrues value from those Kingdoms, and then it takes that value, buys Cub automatically, and burns it. So if you watch that Cub burned number, it goes up over time. But obviously from management fees, the same thing we learned on Polycub is that it's not buying enough, right? So what's going to be interesting is seeing that we implement BHBD and Beehive and XCub and all these different contracts, collateralized lending and governance voting. And once we implement all these things, seeing that number of burned Cub go up and seeing that kind of accelerate. So we'll basically have two models. We'll have the Polycub model, which is the inflation happening every month on that kind of accelerated Bitcoin cycle. And then, you know, protocol and liquidity taking over, buying Polycub and redistributing it to LPs. And that's kind of the Polycub model. Then we've got the Cub model, which is going to be, you know, that set inflation rate of one Cub per block. And then earning from all these different methods, you know, Beehive, BHBD, XCub, collateralized lending, and taking all those earnings and then buying Cub automatically and burning it, the same model that's implemented now. So I think it's going to be, pretty interesting to kind of compare these two models and see how they perform next to each other, and essentially just kind of like. It's almost like two experiments going at the same time, and we get to see, okay, this is what a long-term inflationary buy and burn model looks like. This is what a long-term deflationary buy and redistribute model looks like. And then we've got those two DeFi platforms going forward. And to us, you know, the overall mission of Leo Finance is democratizing, you know, financial knowledge and access. So with Cub, we created that for the first time with our community, which is, you know, you can go out this other blockchain and basically create all this value. Then with Polycub, we extended that branch again. And basically we're looking to, you know, we're looking to push that forward in the long run. So one thing I've been following pretty closely is this Curve idea of, which is what a lot of Curve people are talking about on Twitter, which is that cash flow life, which is, you know, they're buying Curve and they're staking it and they're getting long-term cash flow. And obviously there's a lot of calculations that people put into figuring that out. I know Gerber does a lot of stuff with Curve and staking CRV. But, you know, when I was reading that stuff, I was really thinking about what the long-term vision of Cub and Polycub is and kind of has always been, but, you know, we should refine for the future. And that is that the cash flow life where, you know, everyone on Leo Finance has a place where they can stake their crypto and, you know, securely, reliably earn yield in the long run. Cause there's, you know, there's plenty of platforms out there, but just look at what happened with Luna and UST and plenty of other, you know, there's thousands of DeFi platforms sitting in the graveyard. So looking at those and kind of trying to figure out what we need and want for the future of our community. I think I think that cash flow life motto is kind of what we're going for with Cub and Polycub. And obviously we're in this experimental phase where we're looking for that long-term sustainable model. And judging by the figures around PHIVE and PHBD, I do think that we've reached kind of this really cool model, especially with the X governance going into place. What was that, like 2 or 3 weeks ago? I do think we've reached kind of this sustainable model, and it's going to be something to closely watch as we kind of watch it unfold.
Do you have any numbers on that? Like how much in terms of, you know, to the protocol, how much is being brought in the last, you know, week or month or whatever for all the V2 stuff?
Yeah. So that's a good question. I do want to have Polycub start to put out reports on like the exact figures coming in from each pool, but essentially, you know, from HBD. So from HBD, just looking at that one specifically, there's about 140,000 HBD staked by the Oracle, and that has earned, I believe it's earned about 4,000 HBD so far. So that's 4,000 HBD for the protocol. Just from on-chain staking, and obviously it's staking it at that 20% APR
right. on the high. But there's blockchain. All the bridge fees and the arbitrage, right?
So then where it gets more complex to calculate is bridge fees, which is 0.25% going in and out from wrapping, and then you've obviously got the arbitrage, which I think the arbitrage is going to be probably the bigger number out of all of them. Which is obviously, you know, the protocol transacting PHBD and HBD to arbitrage the price back to peg it basically to the internal market. And then the interesting arbitrage has been the PHIVE arbitrage, because obviously that PHIVE price is a lot more dynamic because you've got the HIVE price constantly moving. Then you've also got the Polycub price constantly moving. So the price is basically super fluid. And then, you know, all that arbitrage volume is already very valuable. And it could be extremely valuable if you see, you know, that PHIVE pool reach, you know, $500,000. I think it's at like 200K right now. So that arbitrage volume is huge. And then, you know, kind of tying this back into what we were talking about with Cub, when we have BHBD and BHIVE launched, you're going to see a lot more arbitrage, just because then you've got those two new pools on Binance Smart Chain. And what that brings for both Polycub and Cub is kind of this synergistic relationship where, you know, when the BHIVE price changes, the protocol or any user can arbitrage BHIVE by, say, buying PHIVE on Polygon, unwrapping it to HIVE, rewrapping it to BHIVE, and then selling it on Binance Smart Chain. And what that creates is arbitrage volume on both sides. It also creates bridge fees for both Polycub and Cub simultaneously. So I think when those figures start to come out, especially when you've got the dual pools going on both blockchains, it's going to be it's going to kind of blow people's minds in terms of how much value can be generated from these vaults, and we're calling them V2 vaults because they're completely different than, you know, if we have a for example, we have like a Polycub Bitcoin vault. A Polycub PHI vault is a lot more valuable than that Bitcoin vault, because of those value accrual methods that we've talked about like 10 times on the podcast. But
a couple of things come to mind with that. So one is that it's hard to, like, with the arbitrage. So if you go from let's just say PHIVE, right? So you got PHIVE Polycub arbitraging against Hive on Hive blockchain. When you add a third node to that with Beehive Cub, then it's a network law. So it's not just that you increase by one, it's a square of the difference, you know. So you go from 2 to 3, which is actually like a 4 to 9 kind of relationship. So it should more than double the actual arbitrage volume between that's already going on, which is great. And I just had this idea as you were talking. It's like, well, what if so the protocol on liquidity is doing two different things, right? On Polycub, it's going to buy Polycub off the market, once the inflation is essentially done, and then it will distribute that to the various vaults and things. And then on Cub, it's the buy back and burn model. Well, personally, I like the buy back and burn model better, simply because you're creating buying pressure and then zero selling pressure because you've burned it. It's no longer in the marketplace. Whereas, when you distribute it, like in Polycub, then, some percentage of that, probably a large percentage of it, will then be sold back into the market. And, so the net gain is going to be the difference between those two. And I think there will be some, but it's not as definitive as in like the burn model. So I was thinking, it's like, well, how do you balance those two? And one idea would be, so you take those buyback methods, whether it's Polycub or Cub, it's like, well, maybe you could do something like you look at the market cap of each coin and you buy back the one that is lower until they reach an equilibrium and, raise both markets together. So, I don't know if that would actually work, but it's just, something that just occurred to me.
Kind of like if you combined them and created like a super Cub.
Yeah. Yeah. And as other Cubs are launched, if you're still planning on doing the Avalanche Cub and the Phantom Cub and whatever, then, like the entire suite of Cub universe or whatever you want to call it, could rise together rather than having, huge outperformance on one and then, lagging other things. So something to consider. Because, one of the things I like about doing the show is that it reminds me to go in and claim all my stuff on Cub and Polycub every week. That's what I was doing as you're talking, just going through my ledger, confirming everything. There's a way to check, right, on like what the next unlock date that you have is.
But, yeah, you can check on the contract. It's a little bit of work.
Yeah. Because I think I'm coming up on like 3 weeks since we made the shift. I haven't harvested it. I haven't claimed anything since we switched to 30 days. And so I think we're getting close on that. There we go. Read contract.
Nice.
So I'm looking forward to those starting to come unlocked.
That scenario you just pitched, I'm not even going to attempt to put into the when soon show recap. Because that was just way too much, way too fast, but I like it.
Just supporting, no Cubs left behind. That's the,
there you go. I love it. No, I'm going to start that meme. No Cub left behind.
Nifty Phil thought you were just a mannequin you're being so still.
Yes. It's because I was typing up. We were like 5 minutes in and I'm like, oh yeah. I was like, maybe I'll do a when soon show recap while we're, so then I was playing catch up while I was listening.
Yeah, very handy.
Hey, listen, it's wins everywhere. People that can't watch the show get the recap for at least most of the points we talk about. And it keeps me at bay and not interrupting with jokes all the time. So wins all around.
Yep.
We'll let the smart people talk.
Yeah. So, you know, overall, I think so, you know, before we went live, Cal, you had made the point to Mitch. So Mitch was talking about like, maybe we cut the inflation on Cub, you know, once X Cub is a thing, we can do governance votes and all that kind of stuff. And he said, well, maybe you don't want to cut the inflation because then that limits, you know, growth incentives. And this is a point Edicted has been making for years about how everybody's focused on deflationary tokenomics and how that's, he thinks that's a mistake. So you were making kind of a similar point there. You know, I think it really comes down to, you know, what that feedback mechanism is, you know, so like in the burn mechanism, I think it makes way more sense to keep inflation higher. But then if you're doing a redistribution, then keeping inflation lower is better because you're going to have lower selling pressure over time with less inflation. So, you know, all kinds of.
That's a good point. I mean, like, because if you're in a buyback, like you said, if you're in a buyback and burn model, then it really doesn't make sense to do so. But if you're in kind of just like a protocol and liquidity world, it's like, well, okay, you almost kind of need to be able to create the rewards,
yeah,
to distribute the rewards, because you just don't have those tokens being created.
Right.
So,
yeah. So Cal, I mean, question on you on like the macro point of that is that, so we've seen all the ohm forks kind of, you know, destroy themselves over the last, you know, few months. Has that changed your mind at all about how these models are going to work for Cub and Polycub?
No, it hasn't. I think with Polycub's protocol and liquidity strategy, I'm very confident in what we're building and what we've built so far. In terms of the way this is going to work. So obviously you've got all those value accrual strategies, kind of feeding back into the protocol and liquidity. So you've kind of got like this base income for the, if you look at the protocol as like a revenue generating business, right? You've kind of got like this base income that comes from, you know, wrapping fees, arbitrage, on-chain staking. You've got this baseline, right? Then above that, and if you kind of zoom out, the whole point of the protocol and liquidity is to generate a return that can be, and that return is used to buy Polycub and then redistribute that as LP incentives, right? So if you want to pay an average of, and I actually talked to Addicted about this recently, if you want to pay an average of say 20% return to all LPs across Polycub, right? And obviously that's going to look different because you've got the X Polycub governance, which may say, okay, we want, you know, the PSPS vault to earn 5% and we want the PHBD vault to earn 35%. And Neil doesn't like that. But you've essentially got this setup where, let's just say across the platform, the average return is 20%. And in order to do that, let's say that you have $1 million LP'd on the platform, you basically need that protocol and liquidity to generate $200,000 a year. In order to buy that $200,000 worth of Polycub and distribute it back as LP incentives. So, you know, where this model starts to get interesting, in my opinion, is not where you say, okay, there's $1 million in protocol and liquidity and it's generating a 20% yearly return and it's paying back that 20% yearly return to LPs who have $1 million on the platform. That's kind of like, you know, 1 + 1 = 2, right? And that's not super interesting in terms of a DeFi platform. What you really want is exponential mechanics in play where the protocol might have $1 million in protocol and liquidity, and you don't want it to just generate 20% a year. You want it to generate, say, 40% a year. But how do you generate a 40% yearly return, you know, consistently? And that's kind of like the eternal investors problem of that they're all trying to solve is, you know, how do you beat the S&P? How do you generate a good return? How do you generate alpha? I think the protocol does this in a super smart way, which is that it has the protocol and liquidity. Then it leverages what's in the protocol on liquidity to generate different things like collateralized loans, synthetic assets. These are kind of all in the baked into the long-term model, which is, you know, the protocol might have $1 million in protocol and liquidity. And then it's LPing those assets on different platforms to kind of bring in a yearly return. And then it's issuing things against that, those assets. So it's almost like borrowing. The protocol is almost like borrowing from the community in order to generate a higher return. So imagine that there's like $200,000 in USDC held by the protocol. The protocol could LP that $200,000 and then essentially take a synthetic asset loan against that, or it can loan out synthetic assets to users. So all this stuff is, it kind of gets into the weeds of you know, the long-term vision that I've had for Polycub. But essentially what we're looking to do is spin up that protocol and leverage it to generate a bigger return than you know, just like a basic, you know, 20% yearly return on say $1 million, which could then lead to $1 million being LP'd on the platform. So that's where I think things get interesting, is that the protocol essentially has more leverage than any normal user could have in DeFi. And the reason for that is because the protocol controls things like PHBD and PHIVE, and obviously its own liquidity. And then you've got bonding and the collateralized lending vaults. I think Addicted is most excited about the collateralized lending model, where people can stake their X Polycub and take a loan against it from the treasury. And then when or if that position gets liquidated, the protocol actually takes that X Polycub and it sells it through bonding. And he's just kind of interested in the game theory mechanics of how that's going to work.
That's actually also what I'm excited about in terms of future, the collateralization and be able to borrow against. I mean, that's called more ammunition, more powder.
Yep.
Give it to the cat. He's ready.
Well, and if you want to look at kind of one of those other features that we're getting ready to launch, is I put it in the title of this podcast, which is Vex Polycub. And I kind of explained it, I think, on the last AMA, just a little bit. Essentially what that is it's voting escrow X Polycub, which sounds way more complicated than it is. Basically, it's a locking contract where you can lock your X Polycub for 2 years and then use it in governance votes. And if you lock it for 2 years, you get exponentially more governance power than someone who just is holding regular X Polycub, which is obviously instantly liquid. So you'll be able to stake your X Polycub for loans. You'll also be able to stake your Vex Polycub for loans.
Yeah. You know, obviously we have to see the details, but it is interesting. So like, you know, with Curve, you know, they have their VECRV, which is the voting enabled Curve token. And one of the more interesting things that has been done with it is you have a platform like Convex comes on as a second layer to CRV. And so they have a method where you have CRV, you lock it with Convex into their pool of CRV. So you join like it's like a mutual fund of CRV kind of thing. And then they give you their token in response, and they create a market between CRV and their token to keep them, you know, to keep liquidity between them. So, you know, the goal is always to find like a no downside kind of scenario, because, you know, giving up liquidity for 2 years or 4 years or whatever it is, you know, like is basically forever in DeFi. And so, you know, there's always that big hesitancy to lock up your tokens like that, because, you know, in 2 years it could be zero, you know, who knows. But if somebody can come along and solve that liquidity issue, then with like an instant staking kind of model, then that becomes a lot more attractive. But you know, if it's something like, oh, you have to lock it in order to get a loan against it, so like regular X Polycub wouldn't be eligible, then you know, that might be more incentive, something like that.
Well, when it comes to the collateralization and the borrowing, is that going to be what it is? Is it like a huge long lockup period, or is it just basically as long as you hold the loan and you can get liquid if you pay it back? Or
with the X Polycub loans, you basically, it works exactly like if you've ever used like a MakerDAO vault, for example, or Aave. You basically lock up the token. So it's X Polycub in this scenario. You lock up X Polycub in a contract, and the contract pays you, say you lock up, you know, $1,500 worth of X Polycub, and the contract gives you $500 in like a PHBD loan. Now you've got your $1,500 worth of X Polycub locked up, and then you've got the 500 PHBD liquid in your wallet. You can do whatever you want with that 500. As soon as you pay it back, you get your X Polycub back and you can do whatever you want. So it's not like a lockup of any kind in that scenario.
Cool.
Yeah. You know, I'm just, you know, thinking about like, you know, how much incentive is just governance? I don't know.
It's some, but I mean, I've obviously like that whole, like, I forget what you were going to call it, but, you know, lock up X Poly for 2 years for additional governance. Like, I would probably commit something to that, but it's going to be like a minority of what I hold, but I still just want to have a little extra say in voting matters. So I can vote against SPS.
Yeah.
How dare you?
Just a battle Neil.
One thing that we're considering is, and this obviously would ironically get put to a governance vote, is what if, and this goes back to that kind of that, the mission of the platform of Polycub and Cub, which is that cash flow life and generating a long-term return that's stable, reliable. One thing that we're considering, which is kind of similar to how Curve works, is if you took the yield from the platform, so say you took a certain percentage of the yield that's generated by the platform, that's obviously generated by that protocol and liquidity in the long run. And instead of paying yield to X Polycub holders, the only value prop of having X Polycub would be voting on governance, but also having your Polycub be liquid. Then you would take the yield and distribute it to the VEX Polycub holders. So say that if you lock your VEX Polycub, obviously you're locking your X Polycub for 2 years. And then a return is set by the governance, which is say like 10%, right? So 10% APR on staking VEX Polycub, plus you have that huge governance incentive, which is, you know, your governance votes are worth, you know, 3x what an X Polycub governance vote is worth. And you basically lock your VEX Polycub knowing that you're going to earn 10% a year no matter what, plus have that say in governance. This is kind of similar to the way that Curve works in that, you know, people are playing this game where they buy Curve at a certain price. You know, and obviously people have all sorts of calculations for this, and then they stake that into V Curve, and they lock it up, and their expectation is, you know, based on, you know, trading volumes and other sources of revenue for Curve, you know, they're trying to predict how much APR they're going to basically earn over the long period of time. And then obviously it gets more complicated when you start looking at things like convex and those second layers, and kind of like the governance bribing that goes on with Curve. But that's kind of something I've been toying with in my mind, which is if the yield is actually paid out to VEX Polycub holders instead of X Polycub holders, and you kind of change that entire value incentive and kind of go push it further toward that vision of long-term reliable yield. And obviously a big point of reliability and sustainability is locking up a bunch of Polycub. You know, so what you essentially want to see is you want to see a lot of Polycub in the actual Polycub pools. So like PHI Polycub, Polycub BTC, Polycub ETH, you want to see a lot of liquidity there. Then you also want to see a lot of Polycub get locked up and see it in that VEX Polycub contract where now the circulating supply of Polycub is super low, but you still have a lot of liquidity. This is kind of creating an interesting incentive model in the long run, which is, basically that cash flow life is returned to people who support the platform, either by providing liquidity or locking up their ex-Polycub for a long period of time. Because ex-Polycub is useful, but since you're not locking it up, it doesn't have as much value to the platform. And this goes to that larger narrative that everything we're looking at now is all about driving value to the protocol. So that's kind of something I've been toying with. And obviously it'll go to a governance vote if and when we kind of put up a proposal for it.
All right. So, I mean, you're mentioning a lot of new features. So then the question is when? When do we get bonds? When do we get governance UI? When do we get... Just soon. Okay.
When?
All the soons.
And then so, have a soon for every when.
Complete sidebar, because you know, hashtag ADHD. For all the Leo Lions out there, and for the people that are trying to spread the word, and for the future ambassadors that I believe are coming, legit, wherever you live, especially if it's in the United States, just go on Meetup and like search crypto or Bitcoin and oh my God, events. Like I know South Florida is like kind of like crypto heaven, so to speak, in terms of events, but like I can go to 3 events this week if I wanted to. Like, so if you want to get the Leo Finance word out there, there is definitely local events wherever you live, especially in the United States. So get out there, be social, and wear your Leo pride. And bless people with access to Web3, Leo Finance, because all it is value add. Costs them nothing and just adds value to their life. So random call to action for the Leo Lions.
Well, you know, it's not so random, you know. So Cal, there were a couple tweets out or announcements about the communities pages that we talked about last Thursday. Like we went... I didn't even really understand what you were talking about. So what's the update with community pages?
So I actually, we just put up an update right before we jumped on here. I just linked it in chat. The community pages feature is a lot. We kind of did an interesting thing with the community pages, which is, we didn't just go for releasing a new feature with community pages. We went for an entirely new Lightning update, which we did for a few reasons. It was an attempt at killing two birds with one stone, because the Lightning database that we've got needed to be updated, basically to support a bunch of different things like the mobile app. And kind of doing all of this stuff at once is what led to, you know, kind of like this cascading number of issues that needed to be solved. And we released it. So we had it in basically a private alpha for a little while, tested it and things looked fine. Then we released it to production last week and we did our launch party on Thursday. And then, you know, obviously the community dug up a bunch of different bugs basically in that release. So we were basically patching the bugs as fast as we could and trying to make it, you know, basically just trying to get all the updates pushed out as fast as possible. And pushing things into production definitely helps us, because you can keep things in a closed alpha environment with, you know, 5 to 10 people testing it. And, you know, there's plenty of things that can't get discovered in that type of environment. But then when you push it live to, you know, 600 people, then you've got, you know, a whole new environment and you're basically throwing it into the fire and seeing what happens. So when we released it to production, we found probably, you know, 20 or 30 bugs. You know, all sorts of things like Lightning comments weren't working. So like you would comment and it wouldn't show up right away. You know, so editing posts didn't work. At one point, Lightning actually fully broke and then you couldn't even publish a post. So there's all sorts of issues that we found. We basically collected all those bug reports for a couple of days. And then as of yesterday, we decided to take down the update and roll back LeoFinance.io to before the community pages update. So doing that kind of lets us, it lets the user base basically use Leo Finance without any disruption. And then we rolled it back to the open alpha UI, which I'll link here. And on this open alpha UI, you can still use community pages and basically test all the other features of Leo Finance. So if you want to help us, go use the Alpha UI and you know, do all your normal Leo Finance activities. And if you find any bugs, open a bug report ticket in Discord, because then we can fix everything. I think that we have almost all, if not all, bugs already kind of indexed, and we're working on them. But you know, obviously there can always be more. That's one thing you'll never have a shortage of, is bugs. So this, and I talked about it in more detail in the post, but this release had a lot of complexities to it, especially because of Lightning and all the stuff that we were trying to achieve at the same time. But yeah, I think we're probably a few days away from just re-releasing community pages. But I didn't want to see, you know, the breaking point for me was when I saw that people couldn't even publish a post because of Lightning, you know, kind of going off and on. And that's when I kind of just decided we should roll back and then redeploy it, after we fix a bunch of things with Lightning. So, the current status is we're fixing the current list of bugs, which is, let's see how many we got. I think we got like 6 or 7 on our list that are left. So things like, you know, overriding fake comments, that basically Lightning puts up a comment faster than the Hive blockchain can index it. And that's what gives you that Lightning user experience. So we've got an issue right now with that. And then publishing posts is kind of having an issue kind of along the same lines where Lightning isn't pushing the post to the Hive blockchain correctly. And then all sorts of stuff with refreshing pages and kind of scalability in general, which is obviously an issue when you've got it on the production interface. So fixing that stuff in the Alpha UI and then pushing it back into production, I think, is where we're at. And if you want to make it smoother for us, obviously using the Alpha UI and reporting anything else that we might have missed is a big help.
And I'm just going to be the pessimist here and say that there's going to be a couple cycles of that. So you
there know, definitely could
you,
be.
You get a bunch of bugs, take it back, fix them, redeploy. Oh, there's new bugs, take it back, and you know, eventually you'll reach some kind of steady state. I would say let's not expect everything to be perfect on the first round.
Yeah, that's the, you know, the fun part about developing is that, you know, you get new features and things get exciting, but the, you know, the hard part about developing is that as soon as something gets released, you know, you can release it into a private alpha and have a few people test it and it looks great. As soon as you release that to, you know, a lot of people at once, you get way more volume in terms of, you know, usage of the system. And that kind of creates all these cascading failures that can lead to the discovery of bugs. And then you got to triage all those bugs and figure out, basically take all the bug reports, categorize them and prioritize them, and then start working on them. And, you know, if you're doing that on a site that is live to, you know, like I said, 600 people, that use it every single day, and then all the readers that come in from Google, it's not like a great user experience to go to the UI and find that you can't publish a post randomly, or, you know, comments are taking forever to load. So this kind of release and rollback is a pretty common thing in software. It's even more common to have, you know, kind of alpha and beta versions of the UI, which we've always had, but the problem is that a lot of people tend not to use them and not want to provide bug reports. So I think at some point it would be nice to have a little like a bug bounty fund where, you know, on the alpha UI, we release all the features and then people can test them and earn a bounty if they report something and we fix it. At some point in the future, I think we'll do that. And that is kind of when you'll see Leo Finance not exit the live beta, we're doing it live phase, but go into a little bit more of a sophisticated we're doing it live phase. That's kind of our long-term roadmap for that.
Gotcha. I'm looking forward to it. I was just looking at the stats on the Simple Analytics. It's 74,000 visitors over the last 30 days. I don't know if Simple Stats has like unique visitors or if those are just total. That's a bunch of people. So yeah, they definitely need to have an experience that's, you know, pleasant.
Right.
Yeah. Experience that has them come back, because first visit, I mean, that's the way it is now. You have basically less than a minute to to not lose that person. So if they come to a site and they're waiting 30 seconds for something to load and or something doesn't work, and that's the first time they've been to that site, basically, bye, Felicia. Not going to see them again.
It's true.
It is.
I've done that plenty of places. Like, if it takes too long to load, I didn't care that much.
I do that shit all the time as well.
You know, I click on an article and then it hits me with some crazy pop-up. Like, I can't figure out how to close in less than a second. Gone.
Yeah, I did the same thing.
But, you know.
Gone. That reminds me of an inside joke with my business partner talking about Bill Belichick. It's like, gone. His status, his success for everything, just gone. As soon as something's a problem, waste no time. Gone.
Waste no time. Absolutely.
Just cut the fat immediately all the time. No compassion. Gone. Yep.
I was go ahead.
I was just going to talk about the Leo growth account. So we've got a nomad soul who's taken over the role of head of business development. So he's doing all sorts of initiatives basically to grow Leo Finance and you know, basically build all sorts of on-ramp mechanisms and getting people into the community, and then also getting the community, you know, the existing community more involved. So he just started Leo Power Up Day. So obviously, you know, Hive has a Hive Power Up Day every month, and a lot of people participate in kind of this collective powering up of Hive. And it's just kind of like a fun way to encourage people to build their stake in the platform. And he's kind of designed this in an interesting way. I just linked the post where basically there's three winners every month. And on the 15th, there's a Leo Power Up Day. And then you see he's got some rules there. So your total Leo power must be more than 200 and less than 20,000. So he's obviously targeting kind of like this middle class of Leo holders. And then he said you must power up at least 200 Leo on the 15th. And then also reblog the post. So just kind of spread the message out. It's kind of typical competition, you know, guidelines. And then each, basically there's going to be three winners. Each winner gets a 20,000 Leo power delegation, for 3 weeks. So kind of leading up to the next, Leo power up day. So the whole idea here is that you do a couple of things. You encourage people to stake more Leo and build their stake in the platform. The other thing is that you're giving out a delegation to lower, smaller accounts that have less than 20,000 Leo power, who are obviously seeking to build their stake if they're participating every month. And you're letting them build their stake faster by having access to that basically that bigger stack of Leo for 3 weeks. So it kind of builds out that middle class. I know that you know, Addicted Taskmaster and CFL Closers have made, you know, all sorts of posts talking about that, you know, both related to Hive and to Leo in terms of building up that kind of like dolphin class, which is essentially, you know, not a whale, but not a minnow type of setup. So I'm really excited to see what this initiative brings on. He's done a couple other initiatives that have done, you know, super well. So I think it's going to do great things. And then the Provide Liquidity Week he just did, just ended, where basically encourage people to provide liquidity and then kind of get like a lottery ticket. So I think he's going to do that every, I don't know how frequently, maybe once a month. And then the other big thing that's going on in terms of Leo growth is the ambassador program. So, you know, Mitch kind of mentioned it. The ambassador program is basically a selection of people on Leo Finance that have access to a Leo delegation. And then also, you know, kind of get like this Leo payout once a month. And basically it's headed up by a nomad soul, and they're going to do all sorts of initiatives kind of like this one, aimed at growing the platform, both within the existing user base and then obviously outside of it. So I know Neil always loves to ask, how are we, when marketing for community pages and other features? So kind of a big piece of that is going to be this ambassador program, where you've got basically this selection of, say, like 10 ambassadors, and their entire mission every month is to go out and talk to other communities and talk to other people outside of Leo Finance and Hive and bring them into Leo Finance and tell them why they should use it. So I think the combination of this ambassador program and community pages could be, you know, kind of that killer feature with killer marketing that, you know, if we can onboard one community and then start onboarding community members from that community, I think it'll be, you know, you'll see that monthly active users number grow a lot. In the last Leo stats report by Dolls, I think he said there were like 650 monthly active users on Leo Finance. That's people that posted and commented. The goal is definitely to reach like 2,500 by the end of the year. So that'd be a nice close to 5x on our user base. I think we can achieve it with the combination of this ambassador program and the community pages. I think it's definitely achievable to onboard. You know, the thing about communities is that you onboard one community member, and then that community member, if he has a good experience on Leo Finance, now has that built-in incentive to go out and talk to the rest of his community members and say, hey, like, let's build our brand over here. It's an engaged audience. You know, they're willing to buy into the project if we make it, you know, make it known why it's a good project. Kind of look at like what happened with ThorChain and then imagine a more organized rollout of that. And that's kind of the whole idea behind community pages.
I dig it. All right. Chat's been quiet today.
He's making his recap.
What? Oh yeah, I'm typing away. I actually had to move my mic because I saw my thing was like lighting up. I'm like, I don't want to cause clickety clack in the Discord.
Yeah, I think that's the one. Well, that's one of the downsides of my new mic for one is that, you know, at least on my headset, I can definitely hear the clicky clack. But the people want better audio, so that's what I'm trying to give them.
Come on. Don't even front. It has nothing to do with better audio for the Wednesday show. It was all about the Splinterland show.
Well, yeah, that's true. But everybody else gets the benefit.
Which so. I keep forgetting that's actually a thing. I guess because when it was on MSP, it was just like simple, just going to Discord. So
yes,
I have to...
Now it's on Twitch.
Yes, I need to save the link and randomly venture in.
Well, I think it's during your Crypto Newbies call also.
Oh, is it? Oh, well, you do it at 7?
I do it at it's 6 to 7 Eastern on
Tuesday. Oh no, that's usually I'm driving back from basketball. Ah, so
well, there you go.
But it may be raining today, so if it rains, I could always jump in and pretend that I want to learn about Splinterlands because I'm gonna pretend I'm gonna start a fund, that I'm gonna pretend I'm gonna put money into cards and rent. When I think about it, like, hey, I'd like to make more money, and then I pretend I actually want to do all the work that it takes.
There is that.
You know, the cat life's a good life. You sleep a lot, you eat, you go back to sleep, you wander around the house, you occasionally run around. I truly embraced the life of the cat.
Yeah. Knock shit off tables.
Oh, that's great.
So I've got a couple kind of moving to you know, broader topics, especially for mm-hmm. for the clips. I've got a couple of topics. So what do you guys think of gas prices? I know we kind of talked about it a little bit. Neil mentioned something about you know, $140 a barrel being you know, kind of some sort of target. What do you guys think of oil prices, gas prices, what the administration is doing, and you know, kind of what's your hot take on that?
I mean, more money makes prices go up. So I was actually listening to Bob Murphy's show. You know, he does an economics podcast, and it was one of the recent episodes. He was Murphy? Saying, Bob Murphy. You don't know Bob Murphy?
I don't know Bob Murphy.
He's a big name in the Austrian economics world.
Interesting. Neil almost seemed offended that I didn't know Bob Murphy. I'm sorry. Do not discount me as a economist. I will step up my game, kind sir.
All right. Good. So he made the point in a recent podcast that despite all the talk about the Fed, you know, raising rates and everything, that the balance sheet of the Fed has not really decreased at all from the beginning of the year, which, you know, I had not looked at, but, you know, looking at the chart now, it's, that's pretty accurate. So here, I'll even drop a
good, because I was about to ask for it,
a chart,
because finding it myself would take time.
Yeah, so this is the St. Louis Fed, which is their economics database, and you know, you can pull all sorts of numbers. So this is the total assets held by the Federal Reserve, which is a proxy for the amount of money in the economy, because I don't want to go into the whole thing, but that's, you know, base money that is used as leverage by the commercial banking system in order to create money. Like if you go out and get a credit card or car loan or mortgage or whatever, that's all money created based on this balance sheet here. So since January, you know, it was at 8.7 trillion and now it's at 8.9 trillion and it hit a peak of like 8.96. So it's come down slightly, but not very much. So, you know, as long as the money that has been pumped into the economy has been kept in the economy, then there's no reason for prices to come down. And then, you know, where those prices go, like it could be in oil, it could be, you know, cats and lithium stocks. It could, you know, where it flows can rotate to different sectors, but the total amount is going to be, you know, fairly consistent. And that won't really change until the Fed starts actually withdrawing liquidity from the market. And that would make their balance sheet shrink. And, they've done a little bit, a little tiny, tiny bit. And, you know, the stock market's gone down 20% as a result. So, you know, it's, I don't think it's in the cards that, especially in a midterm election, that's going to be hotly contested, that they're going to really suck up the excess money in the system in order to decrease prices, energy prices, because, you know, the rest of the economy will just roll over and crumble if they did that. And I don't think they're going to punish the Democrats like that.
Yeah, I agree. And I think we might have talked a little bit about this last week, in regards to, you know, impact of raising rates versus impact of Fed balance sheet. And everyone's so focused on rates, like you said, when, yeah, that has its impacts and its factors. But in the end, the balance sheet is really what's important. And they have not become a net seller. They keep talking about it. Yeah. And they need to do it.
Just talking about it has scared the shit out of people.
Right. So the only thing they've done so far is they stopped buying, so to speak. You know, and I forget the number. I actually just read an article the other day and it showed the number from like last month in terms of what expired on their balance sheet, right? Yeah. Where basically just like loans, coming to fruition, and which was still a high number, but not relative to what their balance sheet is. Like it was still like a few billion dollars or something, which, you know, is relative. That's like the equivalent of like me, like, you know, seeing $300, I guess, come off the books. They're in a sit and do nothing almost. It's like, all right, well, we stopped buying, but we can't sell.
Right.
And it's like, all right, what's going to come off the books? But there's a lot that could have came off the books that's not going to come off the books, especially when you look at, like, let's just say it's just their, you know, kind of mortgage backed securities, because with interest rates going up now, we went from everyone in the world's refinancing last year to no one's refinancing. On top of that, people are also now less likely to sell their home, which means that loan's not going away either. So They're literally just sitting there and waiting for loans that are actually expiring for the most part in terms of like the major catalyst. It's very interesting, but I agree with you, Neil, in that I don't know that they can become a net seller before the midterm elections. I mean, because if they do, it's not going to be pretty. And since right now, you know, Democrats pretty much hold a full sweep of Congress. I just don't see how the pressure obviously isn't full force for them to just basically shut the fuck up and do nothing for like the next 3 to 4 months.
So Neil, you mentioned, you know, just a little bit of pressure from the Fed, stock market goes down 20%. Mm-hmm. Do you think that the market has has priced, because I think I see a big conversation right now, which is, has the market priced in, you know, Fed activities, or is it just an initial reaction before the, you know, kind of before the big major hit, which is like the actual activities that they partake in? Basically, do you think it is priced in, or do you think we have more room to go down, or do you think the market is mispricing it and you know, the Fed walks back some stuff and market number go up?
Yeah, I think they've priced in what they expect. So basically, based on the Fed announcements that they're gonna hike, they're gonna do it at this 50 basis point chunk, you know, through the various intervals. And it, you know, I'm seeing more and more headlines, you know, from various media outlets talking about the same thing Kat's been talking about, how September they're gonna turn around. And if not lower rates, at least, you know, maintain. So I think that is the scenario that the market is looking at. And, you know, going from, you know, 0% up to, you know, 1.5% or 2% is kind of what this whole recent market move has been about. And then if and when that scenario ends up being falsified and the Fed does something different than expected, then we'll see a market reaction. So if they back off sooner, market will go up. If they accelerate into, you know, one scenario that I'm definitely not expecting is, okay, so they get through November, the election happens, whatever it is, you know, positive or negative for either party. And then the Fed starts to put the screws to people and actually shrink their balance sheet, crashing the market. You know, that will definitely have, you know, a negative impact on markets, but it will also, you know, tame inflation. You know, that's what Volcker did in the early 80s. You know, they jacked up rates to, you know, 21% and, you know, had a 2-year recession out of it, but, you know, it got all the 70s stagflation, you know, dealt with. So I don't think this Fed is going to do that, but, you know, they might roll off, you know, $1 trillion worth of balance sheet money. And then, you know, the market would react really negatively to that. But, you know, who knows? But I guess to answer your question, I think the current expectations are priced in. And then, you know, if it changes, then the market will change.
And just for, you know, I see a lot of people talking about, you know, there's, because now I think everybody's talking about the inflation conversation. Like you see it. Mm-hmm. You see like the everyday person just kind of talking about it, which is unusual. You know, if you talk to them about, you know, 5 years ago, they had no idea what was going on with stocks, crypto, inflation. Yep. So for people that might not know, what would you define as, you know, hyperinflation, you know, deflationary environments? And then, you know, a lot of people are throwing around stagflation, and I think a lot of people don't know. So how would you kind of define those environments, and what do you think we're in now?
Yeah. So inflation is, it depends on who you talk to, because people have different definitions. So I keep the very old fashioned definition of inflation of being related to the money supply. But what most people think of is inflation as being an increase in the general price level of goods and services. So like, so Kat has this fund that he's thinking about getting off the ground, and he's talking to these lawyers. I gave him the name of the lawyer that I used to set up the Splinterlands Fund of Venari Syndicate. And apparently the lawyer's price from November has gone up 50% to now. And some of that inflation is just going to be, some of that is just going to be demand, but also some of it's just, you know, prices are higher now than it was, you know, 7 months ago, 8 months ago. So inflation, most people consider just to be rising prices. Hyperinflation is one of these, you know, no clear definition terms where most people just mean very high, where you're looking at month over month kind of numbers instead of year over year. So, you know, when we talk about inflation being like 8.2%, we're talking year over year, you know, from March of 2021 to March of 2022. Hyperinflation, that kind of environment, you're talking about like, well, you know, the price of bread was $3 last month and now it's $3.50. That's a noticeable change. So, you know, your attention span has narrowed down because the inflation is so high that you have to. And eventually that ends up with what's called a crack up boom, where inflation is so high that you want to spend your inflating currency so quickly that you'll buy up anything, just anything that has, you know, a stable-ish value, because your money is losing value so rapidly. It might be a different day to day. Like, you know, there have been cases like in, I think it was in Venezuela recently, that people were getting paid at lunchtime every day. And so they would go out and they would buy whatever they could find. And because the next day when they got paid, it would be, they would be able to buy less. So, you know, when you're in that kind of environment, then you're talking hyperinflation. I've always looked at it as, so, you know, the federal government has a debt owed to various parties, right? Some, a lot of it goes to the Federal Reserve. Some of it goes to individual bondholders, like, you know, anybody could buy a U.S. Treasury bond. Some of it goes to other countries that have bought up bonds. And the federal government generates revenue from taxes and from fees and tariffs and all that kind of stuff. So to my mind, when the revenue cannot pay even the interest on the bonds, then you're in a hyperinflationary scenario that's a downward spiral, because there is no escape from that without default. But again, you know, different people look at hyperinflation differently. Stagflation is a scenario where, you know, for a long time it was believed that you had to choose, in terms of macroeconomics, you had to choose between inflation and jobs, essentially economic output, so that, you know, as you tuned up one, you know, you got more of the other. And so it was thought until the 70s basically that you could not have high inflation and a weak job market at the same time. And then that was proven to be false, because you can. So stagflation is when the economy is stagnant, not growing, and you have high monetary inflation. So prices are rising and all that kind of stuff, but the overall economic productivity is not participating in that rise in prices. So it's just getting more and more painful to, you know, operate in the economy. And, you know, we can see that's kind of the environment that we're in now, where we have appreciable, you know, inflation, you know, 8% or whatever, and real GDP growth is way, way below that. So we are having, basically a shrinking economy and inflation at the same time.
Doesn't sound good.
Not pleasant.
No. And, you know, stagflation has been talked about a lot. Like, there's one economic newsletter I've read. I should say I've read, because I don't always keep up with it, but it's been 20 years now. And on and off, he's talked about stagflation a lot. And it's like, we never really got it. But I think it was just a matter of time. But something I found really interesting was, you know, they kind of deep dive in terms of research and debt levels relative to other countries. And Neil mentioned where, like, the revenue doesn't even cover the interest payments, so to speak, to put it in like layman's terms, right? And basically what they came up with on their analysis was like, everyone thinks it's way worse than it actually is. Sadly, we can continue probably at the rate we're going in terms of debt creation until the end of this decade almost, before it really blows up and we get to that point where the ratio is so out of hand, and on the level of some like European countries that are already there. And that was, to me, baffling, and actually shifted my mindset from being way less bearish, so to speak, in just terms of the overall increase of potential prices, which, you know, we've seen over the last, because that came out, I think it was in 2020 they came out with that. I mean, and just look at the last 2 years of debt fueled growth. And, you know, when does it end? I don't know. Maybe, you know, the inflation puts the brakes on it for a while and there's a little pain for a year or two. But think about it. We suffer for a year or two, maybe, right? But as soon as they can basically turn the faucet back on, they're going to, because it's the only option they have. And they can, because
that's the only thing the Fed does is,
yeah,
money printer on, money printer off, and then all the rest is noise.
And we're
to
still
burr
not,
or not to burr.
Yes, exactly. And we're still not near that point where that, you know, debt to revenue ratio is quote unquote a problem. It looks ugly now, but
yeah,
it doesn't outpace. Yeah, it doesn't outpace. I forget exactly what the numbers were too. I wish I could recall what, I mean, obviously it's a couple of years ago, but yeah, there was a lot, just put it this way. There was a lot of room to go still. Like, I think it was like, I don't know, maybe like a third of something in terms of the percentage. So we could still 3X. At this point, it's probably half because the last 2 years have been insanity.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny. I obviously doing taxes, I deal with a lot of people's financial information. And 2021 was the best year for a lot of people, money-wise. And now we're seeing that, the flip side of that is coming in the form of all that inflation and kind of a weakening job market. The Fed had in one of their speeches recently said that, well, you know, unemployment's at like, you know, 3.whatever%, using their kind of gimmick numbers where we don't count people who are just chilling, doing nothing. We could increase unemployment to like 5% and it'd be okay. So they're kind of setting that expectation that the job market's going to get worse. And that is, by design, because they are trying to battle inflation and manage a soft landing, as they call it, which is going to fail. Nifty Phil says, when recession? Let's say we are probably in recession right now. We won't know till later, but, in the old days, it was two quarters of GDP shrinkage, two consecutive quarters made a recession. And now they have a board, because, you know, it's the government, and they decide when we are officially in recessions or not. And it's always like after the fact. And then they'll say, oh, yeah, those 4 months back there, those were recession. But you can see on the chart, that was from that link paste that Cal put in, those gray areas are recession. So, you know, that COVID recession lasted 3 months, apparently. Try ordering stuff and see if that's still true.
So, speaking of recession and inflation, where do you guys think, where is your preferred, safe haven? And I think obviously, you know, given that we're all in crypto, it's going to be probably skewed a certain way, but starting with you, Mitch, where's your safe haven for inflation and, you know, numbers go down?
Honestly, right now, I don't have conviction in whatever my answer is. Historically, real estate's been a pretty good play. And obviously I have a chunk of exposure to that. It's probably more of the same for me, just real estate and crypto. I don't know if I really look at, I know it still is, but gold, I'm just not excited about. I own some gold and silver. I don't plan on getting rid of it, but I also haven't bought any more gold and silver in probably 3 years. And I have no intentions of buying anymore. So I'll probably personally just stick with real estate and crypto, which is also why of late, the only thing I've purchased on this dip has been Bitcoin. I haven't added to any alts yet. And I don't plan to unless we get another leg down. So, yeah.
Yes. Senor Coconut says homesteading skills is his recession haven. That's solid if you can do it.
True.
Providing for your own lifestyle on a very basic level is pretty helpful. I agree. Gold has not been, it's basically doubled from a decade ago, which is decent, but it's been outperformed by pretty much everything. So, And we've had inflation during that time. So, the promise as an inflation hedge, I think, is not really held up as well, at least in this medium term time frame. You know, you could argue that over like 100 years, it holds up. It's like, okay, that doesn't actually help me.
Actually, could you? You know what I've never looked at? I'd like actually to look at what the performance of gold since 1971, because inflation is like 2,000% over the last 50 years.
It's worth looking at.
In fact, go and double check what check the exact.
Well, the trick is getting the data.
Yeah, well, not so much gold. I just want to double check on the rate of inflation since 1971.
Yeah, there's that CPI there's that calculators chart, right? And stuff. But, you know, for me, you know, inflation, you know, I basically it's LPing USD against Bitcoin. It gives me that middle ground hybrid position that I like a lot. And
it's not a bad play.
You know, I've been waiting, you know, with this whole Bitcoin market that's been 29, 32, 29, 32, 29, 32. I've been waiting for it to hit 27. I've got orders in, I've got them ready. But, you know, I don't, but maybe the support holds and 29 is it. In which case, you know, I've been thinking about starting to dollar cost average into liquidity pool positions. So that, you know, if it does fall, my fall is mitigated because of the LP dynamics, you know, by square root of behavior. And if it does rise, I've at least caught some of the bottom. You know, I've bought a little bit here and there of Bitcoin, but I still have a large chunk of USDC just sitting there waiting. So
wait, hold on. So maybe something's not clicking in my brain, because if you're LPing and let's just say it's Bitcoin USDC.
Yep.
And Bitcoin's going down.
Yes.
That, I guess you're dollar cost averaging in a way, so that maybe makes it sort of a better scenario. But in the end, you're actually getting more exposure to Bitcoin as it goes down.
That is correct. But the money, the Bitcoin I bought, you know, higher is still losing money. It's just losing money at a square root pace compared to
it's being diluted, so to speak. Yeah. Because you're buying more.
Yeah. So by dollar cost averaging into that, you're kind of getting like a double averaging smoothing effect.
No, it makes sense. And it puts it on autopilot for you.
Yeah.
And you're getting yield.
So I've been toying with that idea. I haven't pulled the trigger on that. I still have my stash of cash there waiting. Cause it's like, well, what if I'm wrong and it falls to 21,000 and then I could have bought all those more Bitcoin, you know? So
true.
That's so Neil, map that out. For you know, for people, if they put $1,000, let's say compare putting $1,000 just straight up into Bitcoin, dollar cost averaging, say over a month's time, mm-hmm. versus $1,000 dollar cost averaging into an LP position, what does that look like if Bitcoin goes down to 21? What does it look like if Bitcoin goes up to 39?
Right. So if I buy Bitcoin straight out and it falls to 21. Now I've lost a third of my value, right? My 1,000 is now worth, you know, 700, let's say. If I take that 1,000 and put it into an LP and it falls to 21, I don't lose 30%. I lose the square root of 30%, which is going to be like, you know, 11% or something like that. The math gets slightly complicated, especially if you're DCAing into the whole thing. So my position value will be higher than it would have been if I just bought Bitcoin straight. Because you have that internal balancing act that happens inside an LP. On the flip side, if Bitcoin rises, it goes from let's call it 30 to 40, you know, it would have gone up by a third. And my LP position would have increased by the square root of that. So, you know, would have gone up, you know, that same 11% or whatever. So the having a stable coin against Bitcoin just reduces overall volatility of your Bitcoin exposure. And you pay for that on the upside by getting less gains, but you save it on the downside by having less losses. And then, you know, there's additional factors where, you know, if you're yield farming with that, you're increasing your internal returns, which is making that spread even more positive. So if in the dropping scenario, you're dropping even less as you add to your position through yield farming. And then as you dollar cost average, well, you know, that creates, I mean, effectively what that creates is multiple positions and how each one, you know, gets marked to market with wherever the market ends up is going to be independent, but you're able to blend all those positions into one and get an overall average that is going to be, you know, less volatile. So, you know, it's not a simple scenario, basically, but you're You're gaining reduced volatility at the expense of potential performance.
The only scenario to not do it is if you are 100% positive that Bitcoin is going to double tomorrow.
Right. Yeah. If you're super bullish and you're convicted that this is the bottom, then just go all in straight up.
Yep.
So I'm not in that case.
What I've learned in this last 2 minutes is that the Bitcoin that I recently bought and then I plowed into the single stake Bitcoin pool on Cub DeFi, I should pull out immediately.
Maybe. And
pair it up against some USDC. The only problem with that is I'd have to take it off Cub DeFi because what do I got? You got Bitcoin BUSD, I think, on PancakeSwap. So, well, yeah, the closest option.
Bitcoin pairs everywhere, you know.
Yeah, the closest option as far as on Polycub is the Tri Crypto with Ethereum, Bitcoin, and US DC.
Yeah, how's the yield on that these days?
I have not looked for a while.
Pretty solid.
I'm still 24%.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know what the thing is too, honestly, like maybe if I end up buying more Bitcoin if we go down, or maybe I'll just set up a pool now so I don't even have to pay attention to it. But what I've already purchased in the like this past few weeks or whatever it was, I wanted more Bitcoin exposure. That's just going to sit in the single stake pool, earn its little yield, and I can ride or die Bitcoin up and down.
Yep. But, you know, I was reading an article about Paul Tudor Jones recently. And so he's a, for those who don't know, he's a pretty legendary fund manager.
Dude's still alive?
Oh, yeah. So he's been around since like the 70s as far as like a fund manager. And he's basically, he's unique in that he's made money like every year and has had like almost no drawdowns, which is phenomenal in the money management space. Because a lot of guys, you know, they'll make money some years, it'll be great, and then other years they lose money, and you know, you end up maybe even, maybe better, maybe worse. But you know, but Jones has done a remarkable job over a very long time period of making money consistently. You know, years will be bigger than others, but overall making money. And you know, his thing was basically, you know, Warren Buffett's, you know, quote is like, you know, rule number one is don't lose money. So so you know, I've been thinking about that lately. It's like, well, if I want crypto exposure and I want to not lose money, what do I do? And you know, crypto is such a volatile beast that it's hard to know what to do. So I mean, there are these volatility mitigation strategies like LP positions and yield farming and that kind of stuff, but even so, it's hard because we really, really don't know where the market's going. And you know, in stocks and equities or equities and bonds and commodities, there's a lot of different stuff going on, but crypto is all tightly correlated with each other. You know, if Bitcoin falls, the rest of the market's falling. If Bitcoin rises, chances are the rest of the market's rising. So there's kind of like a only crypto on off and very little alpha outside of that. Unless you're talking microcaps, Polycub, you know, sitting right at 20 cents right now. It's been up from, how low did it get? Like 12 cents, 13 cents, something like that.
13, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's driven because it's such a microcap that, you know, a couple players can move things around, and people buying, you know, some Polycub for governance voting is enough to raise the pricing and keep it there so far. So that's not so tightly correlated to the rest of the crypto market, but anything beyond that, like your Bitcoins, your Ethereums, your Solanas, your BNBs, Luna's its whole other thing, you know, in a negative sense. So all of those pretty much move together. Some, you know, are more extreme than others. They have higher beta, but they're all going to be following the same trend lines. So with that environment, it's hard to pick just, you know, a winners or at least not losers without, you know, taking on the volatility of everything else. But as far as I'm aware, LPs are kind of the best place to do that, to get some sort of hybrid solution. And Nifty Phil saying Polycub Weath is the place to be. I'm in Polycub Weath, I think.
I
oh no. I'm not anymore. I moved it over. I'm now in P-Hive Polycub because of that governance vote.
I did not move anything because of the governance vote, but I am in P-Hive Polycub.
Polycub Weath is paying 113% right now. Not bad. I'm interested to see how the price responds once the 30 days after the switch changes. Because, you know, so many people have done the same thing I did where, you know, they were taking the penalties early on, you know, up until we had that switch. And now we're just waiting because, you know, 30 days is not so long. 90 days is too long. And
yeah,
you know, so I think we'll see a lot of liquidity come up to the market and, you know, a good chunk of it will sell. Some of it will go into governance. Some of it will go into farms. But yeah, expect some selling pressure once that happens.
Well, we have, when did we have that governance vote? April 28th. So we are almost a week and a half in?
April 28th?
April 28th.
Was it? So then when did the actual change happen?
Let's see. April 29th.
Yeah. So I must have waited longer than I thought to start harvesting. Because that's more than 30 days.
Yep, that we are well past 30 days.
Interesting.
Let me look at my wallet in Polygon scan.
This here was the countdown for it. So we're 10 days over. It's been 40 days.
All right, so if I go to ERC-20 transactions. Oh, it looks like I started this wallet 20 days ago. All right. 10 days to go for me. All right. In that case, you know, the price performance has been even better than I thought.
Yeah. I mean, I think I think we saw a dip right at 30 days, which was 10 days ago. We saw a dip. Let's see if I can confirm that or not. So today is the 7th. So that would have been like May 29th-ish. Yeah, on May 29th, on May 27th, we were 16 cents. May 27th, we went up to 18 cents. That's kind of when we released the governance voting too. So then we hovered at 18 cents and we've just kind of been steadily rising since then.
Gotcha. All right.
So.
Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah.
Interesting. Did you guys see the... Leo Pyro Up Day insurance bad luck prize that post that one alpha put out.
I did.
That's pretty interesting.
Where is he at?
That's pretty cool.
I got it in my show notes here. My notes for the podcast.
Power update insurance.
Yeah, I just stumbled across it. So basically 60,000 Leo delegation for 3 weeks for basically someone that's unlucky over the 3 months. So if they participate in the Leo Power Up Day, June, July, August, and, you know, meet all the qualifications, but don't get lucky enough to be one of the 6 prizes for all 3 months, which maybe someone will fall into that category. And then they can win this.
Depends on how much competition there is, right?
This is true. And then he's got obviously criteria that also, you know, other criteria that has to be met. Can't power down obviously in any of those months. And need to do a post about the Leo Power Up Day, at least one Leo Power Day post each one of those months. Interesting stuff. I've been on my own power up journey for a while and I am, in fact, let me look at my wallet. Maybe I'm hitting it live. That would be cool. Nope, I am not so close. So I've just been organically powering up from my curation rewards and my posting rewards, which haven't been as much of late because I haven't been posting every day the last two and a half weeks. But I wanted to get to 50,000 Leo power, and I am 109 away. Yes. And then once I get to the 50, then I'm going to start taking my liquid tokens and doing other things with them, like probably putting them into LPs. Maybe I'll add to my P Leo and B Leo pools.
There you go. Yeah, I have gotten, so ever since I bought Leo miners way back when, I've gotten super lazy with Leo power up just because, you know, it just comes in. I don't have to do anything.
So. Fucking damn miners. Oh my God. I haven't thought about miners in a long time. Now I'm having like, I'm having PTSD or whatever. I can't even use the acronym.
Yeah. So
breaking miners.
So yeah, I haven't paid a whole lot of attention to it. And you know, I when Cub DeFi launched, I sacrificed most of my Leo stake to go into that, which was a good decision, it turned out.
Oh yeah, I did that as well. I did that even with Polycub. I put a good chunk into PLeo.
Yeah. So it looks like I have 1,000 liquids. So I'll power up 1,000. Is today power up day, or do I have to wait till the 15th?
That's a good question. I don't know if you have to wait until the 15th and do it on that day, or if you can do it throughout the month.
Now that I know Neil has all that liquid Leo, I'm going to hit him with the please sir DM. Please sir, 191 Leo. I mean, 109 Leo.
You know what?
Actually, like less. I'm about to power up 30, so I'm less than 100 away. I'm like 80. Right. I'm going to be like 80 away.
All right.
Yeah, you need to power up on power up day. So that's the 15th.
It's all right. Here's 85 Leo for you.
All right, totally kidding, but hell yeah, thank you very much. That puts me over, yeah, because I'm at 49,921 right now after powering up the 30 liquid I had.
There you go. You should see it in your wallet.
Love it. Well, so, and much appreciated, sir. So what's funny is I know my soul had hit me up asking me about if I wanted to participate in the Leo Power Up Day thing in terms of like adding additional delegation or providing like just any liquid Leo as a prize. And I was like, honestly, obviously I'm always down to help the cause. I was like, my game plan was to get to my 50K. And then after that, anything I was earning, I was going to, you know, plow into LPs. I was like, but next month I can take, you know, whatever earnings I have over 50K and just, potentially delegate it or do some kind of liquid rewards towards it instead of adding to my LP. So take one for the team, but, yeah. I wasn't down for this month because I'm like, got to hit my 50K.
Yeah. Yeah. And What's Up says it has to be on the 15th. So
you got to wait eight days. So really, like someone could just.
Woo's almost there too, but that's way more than.
Oh, yeah. Me. Look at that.
I can't spend the 900.
Me and Woo are in a race.
But
let's see what I'll be over. I can donate my overage to Woo, which is only going to probably be like 9 Leo.
Yeah.
But hey,
yeah. Woo wants to hit it.
Yeah. So on the 15th, I'll power up 1,000 Leo. That'll bring me to 3,000.
Well, so that was my point though. Like, so now, like in a way, you know, well, hold on. Also, is there a qualification in terms of how much Leo power you have, or can anyone, like can whales technically?
200 to 20,000.
Yeah, can't be over 20,000.
Oh, okay. So I can't even, I was going to say, but anyway, let's just say someone that's got like 15,000, right? And they earn maybe decent on their rewards. Like obviously you can, you know, gameplay that and just let liquid stack all month and then power up day, boom, one shot. I like it. Gamifies it.
Yeah. But I'll wait till the 15th, and it's going to be the 15th every month. Is that the plan?
Yep, 15th every month. Kind of goes well with the high power up day, which is on the first of every month.
Yeah.
Oh, hell yeah. There it is.
Wow. I have
6.942 Leo power. I'm going to send to Woo. That's the overage. I'm a dumbass. I can't send it to her because I powered up the overage. Oops.
Delegate.
I could delegate. No, I'll just wait for curation rewards and some shit to hit this afternoon. I always have 3, 4, 5, 6 trickling in on the regular over the course of a day. 1.2, I get like 1.2, 0.6, like pretty much trickling constantly throughout the day from all the voting.
If I get up, was only 45K away from reaching you guys.
So close. It's closer than I am. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5,
yeah. 6, 7, 8. Well, I mean, this is for me. It's been, so how long, Leo Finance? I mean, what are we, 3 years deep now?
July 2019. So, yeah. Almost so coming up on 3 year anniversary.
Yeah, we're coming up. So, I mean, you know, I've bought Leo a handful of times, but not much of that got powered up. Usually when I was buying Leo, it was for B Leo and P Leo. So, this has been basically, it's been a 3 year grind in terms of just curating and posting from my starting point, which I think was like maybe, I don't even know if it was 2000. It was more than 1,000, but I got to remember what that initial airdrop was. I know it wasn't 10,000 because I wasn't an official moderator for PAL.
It was like 50,000.
It was that, yeah, that was a lot.
It was more than that. 30 wow. something.
Let's not talk about
all the mistakes Kat has made. Was a moderator, but just pretty much wasn't an official one because he didn't want a job title. Hashtag mistake, because huge Leo airdrop at the beginning. Didn't buy miners because who knows why the fuck he didn't buy miners, and just watches Neil and Roland print Leo constantly. So let's not talk about the poor decisions.
I didn't buy as much as I wanted to, if that makes you feel better.
It doesn't make me feel better.
I literally forgot I had money on an exchange sitting there. I had some Steam, and I could have bought out like the rest of the miners when Roland was talking about it, and I just bought a little sliver instead. But
there it is, 3 years ago, baby. Steam Leo.
New Scott Tribe on the block.
Scott Tribe. Wow, remember we used to talk people used to talk about Scott Bot.
Yeah. Scott Bot still handles all the transfers.
Yeah.
And it mostly
works. Honestly, that's good that it came up though, because next month probably should do some kind of 3 year anniversary.
Maybe have a little party.
You know, I think I'm gonna channel my inner Trump man and say, all right, Cal, it's been 3 years. Why am I not Lambo yet?
one Lambo.
Wait, I know why. I wasn't a moderator and I forgot to buy miners.
And Lambos are terrible cars. So.
My fault. Oh, yeah. I don't want a Lambo at all. I would never buy a Lambo.
Got to get yourself a TRX.
Yeah, I my new aspirational vehicle is a Ford Lightning.
Okay. Now, my like frivolous FU money is Model S Plaid Edition. Because that thing, like, full blown, you're spending like at least 130.
Who's getting a taco truck?
That's a great idea too. It's the gift that keeps on giving.
That's right. As long as you're willing to do some work or have somebody do the work.
Nope, just hire someone. Nice. We can have a Leo Fest and Wu can have the taco truck outside the venue.
There you go.
Leo taco truck. There you go.
Oh, man. All right. Well, it is 2 o'clock.
It is.
Streaming for a while
now. Time to go. The recap post has been actually finished for 10 minutes because I'm like, well, I don't need to recap the randomness now. So hold on. I'm dropping that into AMA chat now.
Before we drop off, let's change it up for the little exit that we usually do. Instead of me giving a recap, why don't you guys give a teaser for your shows? So Mitch's Crypto Newbie Call and Neil's Splinterland show. Give us a little alpha and a teaser and when your show is.
Go ahead, Mr. Neil.
All right, we got the Monster Maverick show. That is Tuesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. You can go to splinterlands.tv. It'll show you the schedule in your local time zone. So you'll see my show in the list there for whatever time zone that you are in. And that is the show all about Splinterlands, but from the financial kind of side of things. So Today's episode, or tonight's episode, is going to be a little bit dramatic because I'm going to be making some moves, some dramatic moves, at least, you know, dramatic for me. It's, there's not going to be any dancing or anything, but we're gonna move some numbers around, and we'll see how people react to that. The I've been kind of banging the drum on some opportunities in the Splinterlands world for the last few weeks, and nobody's been listening to me because the numbers have not demonstrated that. So you know, if you want to make some money in Splinterlands, tune in.
Rock and roll. I'm sorry, Mitch. I'm distracted by the AMA chat here. There's all sorts of chatter going on. I do a crypto noobie call, and that's really what it is. It is for the noobs. So if you know any normies that need to learn the basics about crypto, send them my way, and I'll get them at least versed enough where they can venture over to Leo Finance and not feel completely lost. 7 p.m. every Tuesday, 7 p.m. Eastern. It's a free 30-minute Zoom call, and do 15 minutes of Q&A and 15 minutes of teaching. So send your normies over and we'll get them schooled up.
And how do you get to it? What's the link?
Yeah, let me drop. Just go to my website. They can plug in their email and they automatically get the Zoom link sent to them.
scarycatguide.com/crypto-call.
I like it.
And my plug is get ready for Leo Mobile V1.
There you go. Awesome. Earn your first crypto in less than 5 minutes.
So you're just waiting on approval, or
We're about to. We just finished all the mock-ups and all the marketing material, and now we're just going to submit it to iOS and Google Play. And then we'll be waiting for approval. It shouldn't be too long, though, since we're already in test flight.
Very cool.
I like
the app a lot.
I got to try and reinstall and see if it'll work for me. I haven't tried in a few weeks now. What is Rue referring to with Taskmaster wants Leo to make 10,000 comments and then you're going to contribute?
Every week we do about, I haven't pulled up ABH's post lately, but every week we do about like 8,000 to 8,500 comments.
And all of Leo Finance?
Yeah, all just from the UI and from the mobile app. So leofinance.io and the mobile app, we always do about 8,500 comments-ish. Let's see if what I can pull up last week.
Gotcha.
Last week we did 8,200. So our goal has been to get to 10K. So
I will do some commenting this week. I openly admit I am not great about commenting on posts and or responding to comments on posts. So
yeah, we got responding 3 days. So until Friday morning. So technically today, Wednesday, Thursday, 3 days.
Oh, that's like the 10K. Month end, so to speak.
Yeah, the week's end every Friday morning, Eastern time.
Oh, this is for the week.
Yeah, 10,000.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, we do a lot of comments.
Do it now. Comment.
You know what? I'll do this. Anyone who we're going to get to 10,000 this week, I'm going to do as many as I can. Anyone who beats me this week, because I give 100 Leo to anyone who beats me every week in terms of how many comments you do on Asher's engagement posts. If you beat me this week and we hit 10,000 comments, I'll send you 250 Leo instead of 100.
Boom. Mic drop.
Love it.
Well, if you're already out there commenting this week, you're already in the game. So I don't know if I can play catch up with 3 days left.
10,000 is a lot, especially for a small community.
I could spend the next 3 days all day long just commenting, but is that worth 250 Leo? Maybe in the future when Leo moves,
it's going to make that Leo more valuable. So,
well, let's say Leo goes to $1, $250. That's decent.
3 days work. I got to move to Costa Rica.
Yeah,
I like it
for sure.
Get it done. Someone get that 250 from Cal and brag about it. Come back and brag about it next week.
I'm shooting for 1,000 comments. So let's see. It's going to take a lot of work to beat me.
I don't even know how to, like, is there an easy way to check like how much I've commented?
Yeah, go to Hive Stats and then
oh, it's on Hive Stats. Comments.
Yeah, even? Go to Hive Stats and then go down to where it says pending author rewards, and it'll tell you. It'll show at the bottom, it'll say like two posts plus 18 comments.
Right, first pending. Oh, there we go. All the way to the bottom.
Hold on. Where do I go? I'm sorry.
Hivestats.io, yeah, and then your username. And then scroll down pretty much to the bottom, like in the middle of the page. It's called pending author rewards. It's right below the analytics charts. And at the bottom, it'll show you your pending rewards, but it'll say three posts plus.
Oh, there it is. Yep. Yep. Yeah. No, I see it. Yeah. Post comments. Wow. I am like, this is like the least active I've probably ever been in a week since the launch of Leo Finance. I'm not even going to share how many posts and comments I have. It's embarrassing.
Anyone can look. It's on the blockchain.
I know. This is true. So yes, the cat fell off. My one post a day for years, finally. Well, obviously I was doing it on Steam for, what was that, 3-4 years before Leo Finance was even a thing. But rock and roll. Cool. Good stuff. All right, people, go get Cal's Leo.
Sounds like a plan.
All right. Sweet. So next AMA, next Tuesday, I don't know what date it's going to be. Where's the calendar? It should be
the 14th.
The 14th. Noonish in this universe.
Sounds like a plan.
See you guys there.
All righty.
Peace out.
All right, see ya.